Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is the mouth of madness. This is the mouth of madness. This is the mouth of madness. This is the mouth. Right, welcome to the Mouth of Manliness. Just need to a couple of shout-outs to my producer, Wergie Productions, for all of his hard work that he does for me. And then I want to do a big shout-out to Nicol Knights, who's been saying some lovely things about the podcast recently. And it's really kind of put wind in my sails. It's been brilliant. And today, our guest is Ashley Lodge. Now, welcome, Ashley. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. And I'm also a big shout out from my end to our mutual friend, Mark Keeble, who did the introductions for all of this.
Yeah, that's right. So me and Mark, like for quite a long time, year, maybe 2 years, tended to be together at work all the time. And we would be driving around in a van with loads of like oiks in the back. And then me and Mark just kind of sorting our lives out as we go along and talk. Like, we would have the most kind of open conversations. It's pretty amazing, but I'd get on really well with him.
And he's a brilliant guy.
Oh, yeah. I think the world of Mark. And you've obviously been friends with Mark for years and years, I guess.
Long time. We were at school together, but we became friends probably really after school, and we've got quite close over the last few years, actually. So, and he said about your podcast, and I had a listen, and he said, get in touch with Nick, because I think Nick would be really interested to find out a bit more about mindfulness, and here we are today.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, he obviously, you know, spoke about you, like, you know, glowingly, and then he was saying,
and I didn't even have to pay him for that.
No. And then he was saying, like, oh yeah, maybe you should get him on. And I'm like, well, yeah, of course, you know, like, I'm up for having anyone on for a good chat, really. And as I was kind of saying before, is that I talk quite a bit, I touch on mindfulness all the time, and I've done elements of mindfulness myself. And some bits have really stuck to me, and I find with the in this season, like, I've done like 30 conversations just like since lockdown, and
wow,
a lot of people kind of, what's funny is a lot of people kind of go, oh yeah, mindfulness isn't for me, and then they'll say something, and I'll be like, that's mindfulness,
you know? Yeah, like, it's just, yeah, it's true.
I'm like, you're doing it. It's just mindfulness has kind of put a label on it a little bit. And then you get uncomfortable. And it's like, well, if something helps you, it helps you. You know,
yeah.
It doesn't matter. So what do you do now then, Ashley? What is do you tell me what you do now?
So I work for a very big educational publisher, and I oversee all of their mindfulness programs. So I've been into mindfulness now. It's been about 7 years, to be honest. What got me into it, and how I've got into the role I'm doing today, because I have two kind of roles. I have a role for this big kind of multinational education company, and I also run my own kind of mindfulness and coaching consultancy, which I kind of do evenings and weekends and around my day job. And I suppose what got me into it was my big thing, if you're talking about, you know, on the mental health side, has always been anxiety. anxiety has been the bane of my life. It's been that little naggy voice that's been in the back of my head that puts that, gets that fear going about anything really. And my mum and dad are both warriors. As much as I love them to bits, you can see that we've got that whole nature nurture thing from there. Much as I love them very much, so I think we've got a natural disposition to be anxious. My brother and sister are fairly similar to me. Don't worry, mum and dad, if you're listening, I'm not blaming you for that. I'm just saying that we are generally a bit more of a.
You can't help but genuine. Like when you're growing up, if you're around anxious people, you're going to pick up a bit of anxiety.
And you know, it is that whole nature nurture argument. So I think we've always had it there, and we've all, you know, and I've talked a lot to my brother and sister about it, and we all identified. I think because we're open about it and we talk about it, I think that is such a good thing. So for me, it all kind of, what took me from being quite anxious and what took me towards mindfulness was when it started off with a conversation actually at the doctor's. I went to see the doctor because I was fed up of just having these bouts of anxiety that would really impact my sleep. I've had insomnia on and off since I was a teenager. And then as a result of being sleep deprived, I'd then get low mood. And I'd get into these cycles of worrying about stuff, lack of sleep. And lack of sleep would then lead to low mood. And I thought, how am I going to break out of this? And I had a bit of a bad episode in 2013. And I went to see my GP to talk about it. And he said, look, what do you want to do about this? He said, we've got different ways we can tackle it. He said, I can either give you like Prozac-style drugs, like Ciroxas or something, that would be quite good, that might help, you know, your insomnia and might also help you with kind of mood when that hits and mitigate the anxiety. But I'd said to him, I'd tried them before in the past and I'd never really got on with them. They'd never worked with me. The first month I'd ever tried those kind of things, I only tried them once or twice. I never really got on with them. So I said to him, I want to see if there's alternative therapies or techniques I could try before I have to go down the medicinal route. Now, I know for a lot of people they work brilliantly, but for me, I never really got on with them. He said, have you heard of this thing called mindfulness? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, why don't you get the book off the course? And it's called, and look, this is the book here, because I know we're recording the video of it, but it's called Mindfulness, A Practical Guide to Finding Peace in a Frantic World.
Yeah, I've got that.
And, you know, and this is, to my mind, this is the Bible of mindfulness. And I read it. I started reading it. It's like any of these self-help books. It's good to start off with, but then you get to a certain point on a self-help course where you're doing the work yourself, and you encounter a bit of difficulty and something comes up and you stop all your good work and practice and then you're a bit like, oh yeah, well that didn't work, stop that.
That's so true. Like, that's so true. You know, even if you're going and having therapy, you kind of, it's all la 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 and then you hit a point when you're like, you hit difficulty.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, exactly. And
it's hard doing these things on your own. It's hard doing it on your own. Anyway, now luck was on my side because the other big thing that was going on for me health-wise is I've had this condition. It's a bit like Crohn's disease called ulcerative colitis. It's an autoimmune condition and one that had to be managed on meds. But I noticed whenever I'd get quite stressed, there'd be a correlation between stress and a flare-up of that. Wow. Now, I don't know how it happened. I think I was going to see someone through my local mind who, you know, you can go to your GP and get help through local kind of agencies. Okay. And Mind had this thing where they said, look, yeah, we can help do some CBT around your anxiety. And I thought, great. And I was doing some great work with a clinical psychologist around CBT for managing anxiety. And then she said, Ash, I think you would qualify for this funding that the NHS are putting out there for people that have got long-term medical conditions like Crohn's or colitis, whatever. And people who've got anxiety or low mood or something like that, to see if we can help the mental health aspects of dealing with long-term medical conditions. So anyway, to cut a long story short, I got on the Oxford Mindfulness Centre 8-week MBCT course, Mindfulness-Based Cognitive Therapy course. Now, this course is like gold dust. Oxford University have the Oxford Mindfulness Centre, which was founded a few years ago now by this brilliant guy called Mark Williams. He'd done all this really pioneering work. He was a psychologist and he got together with some others and was looking at how they could fuse cognitive behavioral therapy, which is the dominant kind of, you know, talking therapy for people dealing with depression, but infuse it with a bit of kind of the kind of techniques you get from Buddhism. And a lot of this work had originally been pioneered in America by a brilliant guy called Jon Kabat-Zinn. And he, if you like, is the founder of mindfulness in the West. He started in the late 70s, early 80s, a stress reduction clinic in America over in Boston. And he was looking to see if he could help people with long-term pain conditions basically use meditative techniques to help have a different relationship with pain that would allow them to maybe have to take less painkillers and analgesics and other kind of long-term, quite full-on drugs. So this bunch of psychologists saw his brilliant work and said, what if we could take some of this brilliant work and adapt it for people dealing with depression? And basically, they formulated what's called MBCT. And they have found, they did a massive study back in, I think it was around 2007, something like that. And it compared Prozac-style drugs to mindfulness-based cognitive therapy for people with relapsing depression and found it just as effective. And this is when mindfulness suddenly went wild. Everyone was like, what's this mindfulness stuff? It was in the news. It was on social media. It was in the papers. It was everywhere. And so I kind of heard of it, but I was a bit like, what is it exactly? So got on that course that was offered at the Oxford Mindfulness Center, and it was 8 weeks. And my business were very kind. They released me to go and do this mindfulness course one morning a week. Every Wednesday, we would get together for 2 hours.
Yeah.
And there was a group of about 15 of us from all different walks of life. And it was a really interesting group. And we would go along and they would teach us the techniques and we'd have discussions about them. And I was a bit of a cynic. Having tried it in the book and got to about week three and thrown in the towel, I was a bit like, yeah, I'm not sure about this. But I'll go in with a sense of openness. They just said, give it a go. So I did it. And little by little, I noticed that there was these really subtle changes. You know, I was doing this body and breath practice, and the mind would wander, but you'd keep bringing it back. And sometimes it felt like, am I making any progress here? Is this working? Because I was just, you know. And they said, but don't worry, that is every time your mind wanders and you bring it back, that is mindfulness. And I went, okay, perhaps. Yeah, and it was just by doing the practice. It was a bit like going to the gym. I'm a recent convert to gym. I was to gyms. I was a real big refusenik. I thought, no, I never need to go near a gym. But then I lost the weight, lost a good amount of weight in the swimming world. And then my mate said, well, you could tone up. You've got a PT. So in the last year or so, I got a PT. And doing mindfulness is a bit like going to the gym, except going to the gym for your brain.
Yep.
And, you know, when I go and see my PT, he will know whether I've been and done those three other sessions in between my session with him, because he'll know how much I can lift and whether I've been buffing up my biceps. They're still a work in progress. I won't strip off to show you the lack of progress on that front. And I just thought it's very similar to mindfulness. You've got to stick at it. Even when you think you're not making any progress, it's a bit like going to the gym. When you lift that dumbbell and you feel that pain in your bicep, you know that you're tearing the muscle fibers and you're building muscle.
Yeah.
And what we know from mindfulness, because we can put people under magnetic resonance and imagery, and we can actually start to see now that mindfulness, we believe, is having this effect that it's rewiring the brain to move it away from the stressy bit of the brain, the limbic system in the middle around the amygdala, the bit associated with fight or flight, to the prefrontal cortex, a bit of the front of the brain, all concerned about calmer, wiser thinking. And for me, it was a bit like, oh, okay, perhaps, that analogy really helped me. The penny started to drop at that moment. Then the shit hit the fan. In the middle of the course, the guy that I was in a relationship with that I thought I was going to settle down with and be with forever turned around and said to me, I don't love you. And the bottom dropped out of my world. And I was just I was a wreck. And I went to the class, and we were dealing around week 5 or 6 of the course. There is this week called dealing with difficulty. And you're asked to bring a problem, and they call it onto the workbench of the mind. And can you imagine? So there you are. Now, normally, they also start with a little problem. Like it might be, I don't know, my garden, the lawn is dying or something. There's something silly, something more insignificant. Of course, I couldn't. My mind was flooding going, oh, no, he's told me he doesn't love me. He's not going to be there at my 40th. He's not going to be there at my sister's wedding. Woe is me. And I just sit and blub. The group was so supportive and so kind, and they said, you know what, mindfulness is going to make, is going to, you know, is going to bring you to the fore of those emotions. But the invitation was to keep being okay with those difficult emotions.
Yeah.
And I stuck at it because I could have thrown in the towel. But I thought, no, I'm so grateful to have got this free NHS place, because it was a pilot study they were doing. Because I thought normally people pay £300 or £400 for that course. And I thought, I'm so grateful, I'm going to do it. Anyway, cut long story short, I finished the course. I got over the heartbreak. And it was my boss who'd sit beside me, a really, really lovely woman, Sarah. And she said to me, Ashley, you know, I think that mindfulness, it's working with you. And I was going, really? She said, you are just so much calmer. You don't get wound up by things so much. And you, I really do think it's had an impact on you, a positive impact on you.
Yeah, you know.
And I was like,
when someone else notices, like, you're just getting on with it, and then someone else will go, you're doing really well, you know. And you're like, am I?
Yes. Because it's so hard, you know, when you're there. When you're there, you can't see the wood for the trees.
No. It's, and I start, I had a course of therapy with Mind, and initially they were like, right, we've got to do CBT because that's what we're paid to do. And I'm like, I used to do courses of CBT with people. And I was like, I don't think it's really going to cut it with me. For starters, I'm a mess. And secondly, like, I'm going to be second guessing you all the time. So that was when the guy was like, okay, let's just do what works for you. Throw everything out the window. Have you heard of mindfulness? And that was my introduction to it. I think there's so many bits of it that I still hang on to. But I think what I wanted to do was ask you a little bit more about, so what did the course entail? Because it's not just meditation, is it? It's so much more than that. It's concepts, which I really like.
Yeah, exactly. So the course it has got, I mean, the gold standard is normally an 8-week course. And each session, each 2-hour session normally has a theme. And all the themes kind of build up one on the other. And all of this has been rigorously researched. That's what I like about it, that it's got a huge basis. This has been through so many clinical trials. You know how many clinical trials drugs go through? Mindfulness has been through just as many, and that's what makes it so powerful to me. But so week one is something around coming off autopilot. And you start to consider how many things you do in autopilot. And what they're telling you about is there's different component bits. So when you go in, they say to you, right, look, we're going to tell you that the psychological education bit, there's always a bit where they talk to you about the theory, the psychology.
Yeah, I like that.
And yeah, I get it. And it's good because I think we all want to understand, if you've dealt with anxiety or depression, you want to understand a bit more about how the brain works. There's going to be a good amount of psychology in it. And they say that there's these two modes of mind, doing mode and being mode. Doing mode does what it says on the tin. It gets things done. That's great. Most of our lives, we exist in doing mode because we're actually human doings rather than human beings most of the time, as I like to say. Mm. But mindfulness, what they teach in mindfulness is that there's a different way, a different mode of mind called being mode. And being mode, it creates, if you like, a pause. Creates a pause where you just have a moment just to kind of fully be present to what is going on in the mind, in the body. Really reconnecting with the body. That was the first part of the journey of the 8-week course. So the first week was about coming off autopilot, how we do all these things, and we've almost automated them, just automatic reactions to situation, automatic ways that we do things, you know, the way we commute. But when you do things in that way all the time, you don't live this life in technicolor, you live it in shades of gray.
Yeah.
So it gives that invitation. We did this silly exercise called eating a raisin mindfully. I don't know if you've ever done that, but it's quite a funny exercise. You're given a raisin. Now, most people would just get the raisin and shove it straight in their mouth. But this time you have to take it and go through all 5 senses to really engage with the raisin. And it's a really silly exercise. But when you do it, you start to think, oh, this is what it means to really be mindful, to really engage with all my senses, to really taste this silly little raisin in my hand. And then week two, you start to look at moving from how we kind of start to analyze everything. Analyzing like work situations and spreadsheets is fine. when you analyze your emotions and issues, then you become like the Woody Allen character that's always talking to a shrink going, analysis paralysis.
Yeah.
And it's true, you go round and round and don't get any further. Yeah. So we start to learn to sense more in our bodies. And when you set, we use the body as a radar to say, oh, what am I sensing going on here? You know, think about all the expressions we have in the English language, I have a lump in my throat, my heart skipped a beat, I have butterflies in my tummy. Mm-hmm. When you come back to your body more, you can sense these things sooner rather than later. So that's a really good way of actually getting in touch with your emotions almost before they might become present to your mind. Week three is about moving away from striving to accepting, to say sometimes it's okay to accept where we are right here and now, even if we're in the smelly stuff. And that's been a real learning curve for me going through COVID.
That's I go on about acceptance all the time. It's like, just like, accept the situation. You can't do anything about a lot of things. Can't do anything about most things. Accept it as it is and stop fighting it, you know?
Exactly. And then life flows. When you do that, I'm such a big advocate of that. Yeah. I think I've heard that in one of your other podcasts I listened to, and I thought, yes, I get that. You know, when you move to acceptance, that doesn't mean that in life you might strive to have certain, you know, certain aspirations, but it's important to say it's okay to be here right now and to feel the way I am. It's okay to be like that. It's not going to last forever.
Yeah.
And that's quite empowering when that happens. That's quite nice when that happens. And then week four is about how you move away from seeing your own thoughts as objective to seeing your thoughts as being highly subjective. And we get to do a silly exercise. I get people to imagine they're walking down the street. They wave to their mate. Their mate doesn't wave back. And then they go, they come up with a story. And the story can be, oh no, what have I done wrong? Why is he not, he's ignoring me. What have I done? Other times it might be, oh yeah, he's as blind as a bat, just ignore it, carry on. But the mind steps in with a story that could be a load of old baloney to rationalize it.
Yep.
And so we get people to start standing back from their thoughts. Week five is about dealing with difficulty. So we start to, like I was saying, take a small problem and look at how we might get those automatic reactions in our body and see if we can take, if you like, a mental step towards it and be okay to approach sometimes problems rather than avoid them. But we also be careful what kind of problem you choose when you're experimenting with this. Don't go for global peace or how we might solve the Trump problem in America or something like that, you know. Exactly. And then week six, we start to, so that takes to week five. And then week six, we're kind of starting to look at what we might want to do with kind of moving into the next bit of our lives and how we might, we do kind of get people to make lists all about the kind of stuff they do on a daily or weekly basis to kind of, yeah, what's the stuff they do on a daily or weekly basis, and to get them to label it all and say, are these actions nourishing or depleting? And when you do it in a class, it can be really quite eye-opening because people might do a whole list of things but go depleting, depleting, depleting. And so we give them the invitation to say, what are you doing that could be more nourishing? What are the things that you're not doing anymore that are nourishing things for you? I get a lot of people who are parents come to the class and they say, oh, you know, bathing the kids is so depleting. They're so stressful. They give me so much aggro. Then other people in the class might say, oh, but I really enjoy having fun with my kids in the bath. And so it's changing it from nourishing to from depleting to nourishing and making sure you get that balance of stuff. And then in the last 2 weeks of the 8-week course, because normally I just teach a 6-week course, it is around pulling all of those themes together, to look at what can I take going forwards? What can I take and do going forwards that will make a difference? What can I start to use differently? You know, what techniques have I learned? Because for each of the weeks of the course, whether it's normally I teach a 6-week more condensed course in the workplace and it's an hour a week, because doing the full 8-week, 2 hours a week in a workplace can be quite a big commitment that everyone can make. And we're encouraged to do for each of those weeks, we talk about the psychology, we talk about how mindfulness can help us shift, and we talked about each of those different shifts. And one of the underlying themes is coming back from how we might have lived. We often relive things in the past or pre-live things in the future. We never actually live in the sodding present moment. Because we're too busy worrying about the past or getting away.
No, what is it? It's like, if you're thinking about the past, it's depression. And if you're thinking about the future, it's anxiety.
Yes, and, yes.
And both of those things are not helpful. You know, like my thing is always try and be more present. You know, you're saying when you do things a lot, you do it a lot and eventually it becomes the norm rather than the old ways are the norm. And yeah. And it's funny, everything you just said there, actually, like all, the whole stages, really. I guess I practice mindfulness quite a lot then. I didn't really think about it. But a lot of them are kind of, they're deep truths, aren't they? The things that you're saying and you're describing, they're kind of really true concepts. And
oh, absolutely. All of it's, and we call them the seven. And so we group those seven sets of behaviours, those seven characteristics, and we say the seven characteristics of doing mode of mind. And for each one of them, there's the opposite doing mode of mind. So you go from autopilot to conscious choice, from analysing to sensing, and so on and so forth over those weeks that I described. And then what you learn, what they teach you, is a formal practice, also called a meditation, because some people have a bit of an issue with the M word.
Yeah.
You know, some people have this big, they think when you're going to do meditation, you're going to go all cross-legged. There's going to be a big guru with a white flowy bin and a big white robe, burning joss sticks. And it's like going, no, you can go to those places where you've got that, if that floats your boat, absolutely. But in a more clinical setting or in a more workplace setting, that wouldn't really cut the mustard. So, you know, we call it practice and we teach practices that are related to those themes. And in week one, we do a simple bit of everyday mindfulness, the raisin practice that I said to you. But the formal practice we do is body and breath. And those of you that are the two key anchors of a mindfulness course, to my mind, that just coming back to the breath, you know, breath is fundamental. And we don't breathe, we know we're not long for this world. We can go a certain amount of time without food, certain amount of time without water, not very long without breath.
Yep.
And so we get people just to come back to the breath. Now, for some people, that's a bit like, oh, even just trying to get them to focus on their breath can cause a bit of stress.
Yeah.
We say to them, look, we're not getting you to breathe differently. We want you to breathe exactly as you do normally. But all we want you to do is shift the focus attention to feel the sensations. So the sensations of the air coming in through the nostrils, traveling down into the lungs and abdomen expanding, and then contracting as the breath comes back up and out through the nasal mouth. And you do that. And they say, your mind's going to wander. That's what a mind does. That's absolutely cool. Don't beat yourself up when your mind wanders. You awaken to the fact your mind had wandered from focusing on the breath, and you just bring it back.
Yeah.
And you bring it back.
And thing you can do that sitting at your desk.
If you've had absolutely,
if you're really feeling stressed out, you can just do that in a few minutes. You know, even that just breathing and just recognizing the breathing. You know, it really doesn't need to be like. I mean, obviously, if you do more than that, it's much more beneficial. But I think people do. They just see it as being this kind of real hippie thing that they can't possibly do. And I've tried lots of different meditations. I try transcendental meditation and I really struggle with it. What I do though is if I'm feeling stressed out, I just try and make myself more present. So it might be something as simple as just noticing the sky.
You know? Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, that's what we call
the present.
Yeah, and that's what we call that kind of practice. We would call everyday or informal kind of mindfulness, and it's absolutely key. And it will be anything where you're in the moment, whether it's playing a musical instrument, whether it's listening to music, whether it's cooking your dinner, whether it's going for a walk. All of that's that kind of informal everyday mindfulness. And one of my key anchors during COVID, during lockdown, was getting out of my bike, because when I'm out of my bike, I'm just there bombing along the country roads and I just connect with nature, and it's just like there's nothing else that can, and that for me is just brilliant. But equally, each of the weeks we get taught a different formal practice, and that's body and breath. Then you move into kind of body scan, where you lay down on the floor of your bed and you literally start kind of somewhere like your feet and you work your way up. That's a great one, especially, you know, what happens is I all say to my class, don't do it during when you're about to go to bed because you'll fall asleep. Yeah. And although relaxation is a nice side effect, it's not the goal of mindfulness, if you like. The goal of mindfulness is just to be fully present and to feel those sensations in the body. And, you know, for each of the weeks, and then we do week three is around mindful movement, a bit of basic yoga. A lot of people are thrown by that. They don't think that, you know, you'd be doing any yoga in a mindful. It's basic stretches, because it's good about sometimes when we strive for our lives to be a certain way, we might strive that we want our bodies to be live and supple and to do all these things we might have done when we were younger. But sadly, when you get to, I'm in the phase of my life I call late youth. I do not call it. I'm in my mid-40s. I call it late youth. Right. I do not want to call it encroaching on what might be perceived by some as middle age. That is not happening to 50 at the very earliest. Let's not go over my hang-ups about age now. That's different podcast, different time. And you go through these different sets of practices, and the invitation is you practice, you do that every day for a week. And at the end of the six or the eight-week course, you're given a toolkit of all these different techniques, as well as all the different psychology, all the different kind of practices and the knowledge and understanding of why we do what we do. And I say, that's your toolkit. When we bring it all together at the end, we say, that's your toolkit. And you can now know, you'll get a sense of, maybe when you're getting really stressed, you've had a real emotional interaction with someone, do what we call the three-step breathing space. It's just like you said, Nick, it starts off with the breath, and you might just be sitting in your seat, and you might just sit upright to change your posture a bit more, focus in on the breath, just ground yourself with the breath coming and going. That's a really simple technique that anyone can do. In the three-step breathing space, we take that and make it part of it. The first step is we say, what's the weather pattern like in the mind right now, to use your analogy about the sky? And, you know, is the sky nice and blue? Is it calm? Are there loads of clouds moving around like the thoughts? Or is there a tempest blowing in? There's no judgment about whether it's right or wrong. There just is the acceptance of what's going on in the mind. Because not judging is one of the key concepts we look at in mindfulness. And I'll pause on that. I'll get back to that in a moment.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, that one.
Then we move to the second bit of it. The second bit of the practice is we then stop the scanning the mind like a radar, seeing whether thoughts occur like blips or like clouds moving in the sky. And we move to step two, which is the focused attention on the breath coming in and out. Because that provides that stop of the mind starting to try to analyze the brain too much. Move to the breath. And then step three, you open it out. You open out the awareness through the body, through the lower half of the body and the upper half of the body, just to say, ooh, what's going on in the body right now? Where might I be holding some subtle stress and tension I might not be aware of? And then when you come out of it, you do just feel that you've got that pause. You've just got that kind of moment of clarity, that moment of balance. And then you can decide, how do you want to respond to that really stressful email that someone sent you with lots of capitals and exclamation marks that you really would just want to fire off a really crappy response back? And then you can decide, what's the wisest, calmest, best response for them and me? Or equally, you could do it before maybe you're going in to have a difficult conversation with a loved one or a work colleague or something. Again, it helps de-emotionalize things, but allows us to have better, nicer conversations with all that fiery emotion that comes once we get stressed or anxious, and that limbic bit of the brain, the amygdala in the middle, fires off. And you get all of that cortisol and adrenaline pumping around your body.
Part of your brain is going, right, protect, attack.
Yeah, exactly. The fight or flight response gets triggered.
You just pull it in and you go, right, just bring it right into here and stop thinking about all of that for a moment. Give your brain a little moment.
Yeah.
And then, it's like you're not in that moment. If you're thinking about your breathing, you're thinking about your body, you're thinking about those things rather than thinking about how angry you are with that person.
Yeah.
And it just pulls you in. And then you go, actually, it doesn't really matter. I really believe in that. I really think it works.
Oh, absolutely. No, for me, you know, when I look at my own journey and the difference it's made, but when I look, the course I teach at my current employer, there's 700 people have been through that. The majority of what I offer is a 6-week program. So it's a slightly condensed version of what I was outlining earlier.
Yeah.
And we meet for 6 weeks. We meet for 1 hour a week, and they get given a handout at the end of it. You know, I take them through the psychology, the neuroscience. We teach. I teach the practice. We do it together. We have a Q&A session. And there's as much support from the group sharing their own experiences as important as me teaching the techniques. And we go through that journey together. And I get them to fill in a load of psychological forms, like GAD-7 and anxiety scale, perceived stress scale, some of these other scales, before and after. And what we see, the aggregate results are giving us something like a picture that after a six-week course, anxiety reduces by 40%, perceived stress reduces by an average about 22%, and focus and attention increase by around 20-25%. And I've seen this replicated by cohort after cohort after cohort. And the reason we believe it's working is it calms down the stressy bit of brain, the amygdala, that fires off, you know, the cortisol, adrenaline, the flight or fight response you were just talking about. But also it starts to build more neural activity in the prefrontal cortex, the bit that's associated with learning, memory, emotional regulation, cognitive flexibility, new and different ways to solve problems, resilience. And those are the two main kind of groups of people that come to me, people that want to better manage stress and anxiety and low mood, or have a very scattered mind and want to bring it together and have, you know, more, a greater sense of kind of focus and attention. And for me, working with all those people that I work with over the years now and seeing the difference it makes, not just in terms of the hard data, yeah, as well as all the academic research from all of the studies around magnetic resonancing imagery, but also just the anecdotal stories. When I get these stories at the end, like a guy phoned me up at the end of the course I ran earlier on in the year, and he just said, I just want to thank you. It just has really, really changed things for me. And he said, and I didn't, he just said, but I stuck at it. I did it. And it really has made a difference for me. And it's lovely. It's lovely when you see people, and he suffered really badly from anxiety. And you get a whole range of students. You get some people who have like the road to Damascus conversion, who are literally cartwheeling up and down the corridors. They've seen the light. But I always say to my classes, that's probably the minority of people that come on the courses that have a life-changing experience like to that level.
Yeah.
I said to most people, you'll probably have something much more subtle. But I said, the most important thing is you don't compare with anyone else. You're on your own journey. I said, you're on your own journey. Don't compare, because when you get into comparison, you're doing that striving thing, yep, keeping up with the Joneses. That ain't going to help you. And then people let that pressure off.
Did you, so when people, so you go to a workplace, so is it voluntary? Like, they're not like told, right, come on, John, you're a miserable bastard. You've got to be. It's like that's hard work, isn't it, if that's the case.
No, mindfulness, certainly not in my setting, and I don't think any of the setting, good practice guidelines would always say that people that come on the course elect to be on it. Now, their line manager in a work situation might recommend it to them, but no one should ever feel forced. And what I always try to do is I run a little sampler session. So I run a 1 hour intro session first to do a lot of the outlining of what mindfulness is. And I use the definition of John Kabat-Zinn, in the guy I was telling you about, if you like, the guy that really made mindfulness popular in the West, to say it is just about effectively our attention and how we formulate our attention in a specific way. That is to say, in the present moment, non-judgmentally, and kind of letting go of anything else and just allowing yourself to kind of be fully in that moment. And that really kind of helps people. So I talk a bit about that. I talk a bit about the practice, and I talk about the M word, and I talk about everyday mindfulness and formal practice. Give people a bit of a sampler, and then most people say, okay, yeah, I get it now, and I'd like to give it a go. But I try not to get. I don't want people just to sign up for the course without having some understanding of what it's about, because it is a commitment. You need to put in the work, and that's why I use the gym analogy. You've got to put in the work and effort. We know the daily practice of 10 minutes or so is enough to start that rewiring of the brain to move it away from the stressy bit.
People go into, I think the problem, like I come up against this quite regularly, is that people, they'll go into something like that and they'll be like, okay, fix me. And then or you go into therapy and you're like, fix me, or you have medication. Yeah. It's like, right, so why am I not better? It's like, because you have to work on yourself. You know, you have to make the effort. If you don't put the effort in, no one can fix anyone. Doesn't even exist. And like, even medication won't fix you. You know, you still got to put the effort in.
Yeah.
And, and it pays off. It really does. It's paid off with me. I'm trying to think. There's one thing I'm trying to remember that the therapist who introduced me to mindfulness said about, you know, like when, you know, bad thoughts or negative thoughts is that you deal with them with compassion and empathy. So is that sound about right? I can't, it was quite a while ago, but it was something that I really, really struggled with. The concept of, you know, like if you're angry with your dad and you're like, you have to just kind of be compassionate to that anger and go, it's all right, you know? And it took me years to get it. And then one day it just clicked and I was like, ah, it's not like you're just not being angry with it. You know, you just stop being angry with it. It's not like you're not going, oh, that's all okay. You're just going, it is what it is. I'm not going to be angry with it anymore. And then suddenly, like, that was a revelation for me when that finally hit. And I was like,
yeah.
Suddenly the weight is just taken off your shoulders. Like, no, it's okay to be angry. But, you know, it's, you observe the anger. You know,
yes,
I feel angry. But I know why I feel angry. I can't necessarily...
And that's so... It's okay. Yeah, you know, and I think it's really important that... I think you've hit on a really good point, because I think the other thing that we're cultivating throughout a course of mindfulness, whether it be 6 or 8 weeks or whatever, is we're just trying to focus those kind of attitudes. And they are kind of things like gratitude, curiosity, openness, acceptance of kind of just allowing things to be and to see what comes up. And it's okay that there's going to be times when, you know, when we are angry. You know, anger is a valid emotion. There are things that happen in this life that when people's behavior to us isn't okay, and it's a perfectly valid response to be anger. However, if you then fall into constant anger about it and are constantly ruminating whatever, then you create a whole thing where it becomes a different beast, and then you're consumed by it. So what mindfulness does is it allows us to say, I'm feeling anger at the moment, and it's okay to feel that because there is some justification for it, but I'm aware about that. Now I'm angry. What am I going to do? What do I want to do? Do I want to continue being angry? Is that going to be a healthy, good option for me? Probably not, because it's probably going to fire a lot more cortisol and adrenaline into my system. That's going to run my system ragged and predispose me to a higher risk of a heart attack or something.
Yeah.
So it allows you to have that moment, that pause to go, how do I want to deal with my emotions?
That's exactly it. And that's the important bit, I think. The fact is, you might be like going, oh, I'm angry, oh, I want to be angry. But if you've stopped for a moment and thought, right, I'm feeling angry now, what's going on? You know, like, what's going on inside? And actually, am I angry with them or am I angry with me? You know, and then by having that inner dialogue, you've slowed it down. You know, just that, doing that one bit, brought it down.
Yeah.
Just step back from it just for a moment.
Yes, and that means
you're less likely to erupt.
And this is having that pause, and this is having that mindful moment where you move out of doing mode, where we're straight away, you know, oh, this has happened. This is the action. You know, action, reaction. Yeah. What mindfulness says is, wait, just pause, just put the brakes on a moment, have a moment to gather yourself, to anchor yourself in the present moment. And, you know, it could be a simple thing like just breathing. You just sit in your chair and breathe. Another technique I had at Weird, I go to CPD courses, you know, continuing professional development at Oxford University, which is just down the road from me here. I'm so grateful I can bomb down there on my bike in 10 minutes, not at the moment because it's all done virtually, obviously.
Yeah.
And I had the great mindfulness teacher, Chris Cullen, and he said a very simple one. And I think he teaches this. There's a big program called MIS, Mindfulness in Schools Projects, and I think this is one that they use there as well. It's called Feet, Seat, Hands. And you just get people in their chair. Just to say a moment, right, have a moment, just feel your feet. And you get people just to kind of wobble, to wiggle their toes, just to feel their toes on the floor. Just say, what's going on your feet right now? Just bring the attention to the feet. And if there's nothing there, that's fine. And then move it to where you're sitting. What can you feel where you're sitting right now? Is the chair comfortable? Is it just feeling the buttocks? And I always dread saying that, especially to my, there's certain people I wouldn't say, what are you feeling in your buttocks right now? That could lead to a whole different conversation, but we'll pause that for another time. And then finally it's hands, feet, seat, hands. What are you feeling in your hands right now? Your hands might be in the lap, whatever. Are you feeling anything in the hands? And just those three simple kind of moving the attention from the feet to where you're sitting, to the hands, just allows you to have that moment where you're moving away from the brain and all the whir to coming back to the body. And that just feels nice and it gives you that pause.
Yeah.
And suddenly you've broken out of those automatic responses or that, whoa, woe is me, why did that bloody well happen to me again? Or isn't that person a right bugger doing that, sending that email to me? And then you go, okay, maybe they're just having a bad day. Or actually, maybe there are some good things happening in my life, but I'm just not seeing them because I've gone down that negativity bias. And mindfulness is great at waking ourselves up to the biases that we have.
Yeah, and we have a natural negative bias anyway, because...
As a part of our survival mechanism.
Yeah, so, we're going to go that way. Life generally seems to... Everything around us has that negative bias. And by doing that, you just kind of... You step out of it for a moment. You step out of that, out of it. Like, I like the idea of, I step out of this like whirlwind in my head just for a moment. Like, I do it. Sometimes I'll do really simple things. Like, if I'm feeling stressed, if I'm walking, I'll recognize the rhythm of my feet.
Yeah.
Really simple. Or, I can smell food. Mm. Come to your sense. You start using.
I love that. Come to your senses, and that is a big thing. It is literally, and that's the invitation. The invitation is to come to your senses, to actually get away from the mental world, and just actually go, oh, what am I sensing right now? And it is when you're in that moment, like a very simple informal mindfulness practice is mindfully making your coffee in the morning. The whole thing of how you brew your coffee, whether it's cafetiere, whether it's instant, whether it's I've got a little Italian stovetop, and it's the whole, you smell the coffee, you watch it brew, you add the water, you add the sugar, you feel the warmth of the cup in your hand, and it's just like, oh, that was an invitation to come from doing mode into being mode, to be there and engage with it. And then that, it's like you said, you mentally shift gear. You move from that doing mode, which is this constant... So that you shift gear into something else which is completely different. And it's just that moment that you're there and you're engaging. And when you can start to make those shifts more often, even if just for a few minutes every day, you get that better balance. You get that better... My friend who's a mechanic is just outside absolutely hammered. I don't know what out of an engine. So, so I've just closed the window over. Now, beforehand,
I've lost sound again. I've lost your sound. Sound's gone. No sound. You must have banged something. So we just had, we lost you there for a minute. I think what I'd like to come back in with is you said about judgments. Is that right?
Yes.
Because that's an interesting one and an important one, I think, that I don't want to miss.
Oh, I think it's one of, Kabat-Zinn in his, he says it's mindfulness is that awareness. And in fact, when I was teaching mindfulness in Italy, I got to teach a pilot of a 4-week mindfulness course at the Ministry of Education in Italy last year. Mm-hmm. And it was so interesting translating mindfulness and the concept into another language. In Italian, it's called consapevolezza, which literally means awareness. Or they just pinched the English term mindfulness. But I was talking about what are the three defining bits of mindfulness, according to Jon Kabat-Zinn. And he said, it's what is our intention behind it, that we have an intention. So our intention is to be fully here in this moment. And our intention informs our where we place our attention. It is that we can only be in the present moment. And that finally, it is to experience everything in as non-judgmental a way as we can. And the reason being is, you know, you were talking about our negativity bias. We're biased towards negative information. This is why newspapers sell, because negative information could be a threat to our existence, and therefore we're predisposed to pick out negative information in case it could be a threat to us. Now, we live generally in much safer times, even with coronavirus, we live in much safer times than prehistoric people did when there were saber-toothed tigers roaming around the horizon to eat them. But that's where that bit of the brain comes from. And so all of the sensory information that we receive, we have to make split-second judgments. Boom, 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 boom. Is this bit of information I'm receiving now a threat to me or not? Is it okay? What do I think? Am I okay with this? Am I not? It makes us judge everything. The problem is, once we start judging all the information, all the situations going on around us, we start to spin out a story in our minds that could be true, but it could be an absolute load of baloney that actually our fear is fueling. And moving away from judging is one of the key dispositions or attitudes we're trying to focus and develop throughout a mindfulness course. And it's fundamental, because when we move away from judgment, we start to move away from straight away, is this a good thing or a bad thing? Am I okay with this or not? And you just allow yourself to be. When you allow yourself to be, you're moving away from doing mode. Doing is, judging is a form of doing. Yeah. That's not to say that when you have your moment to pause and go, what's going on here a minute? You know, using that analogy that I gave earlier about what we do around week four of the course, around sounds and thoughts, and the analogy of the mate walking down the street, you wave at them, they ignore you, they carry on past, and you're kind of like, you spin out a story. What have I done wrong? They don't like me. Oh no. And you start to spin out the story, and there's all this judgment about whether it's right or wrong, or I don't like, and it can spin out all manner of nonsense that's not helpful. When you start to come away from judgment, you actually start to be able to be calmer. You stop judging situations, and then you just say, well, this situation is just is. You know, coronavirus, everything that we've been going through recently, it is. Look, okay, yeah, let's be honest, it's not been easy. It's generally not a good thing. But if I'm always going on about how awful it is and whatever, and always judging and coming up with all these judgments about my response to it, and judging it and judging other people's reactions to it, all it does is keep the mental whir going on. And from a mental health perspective, this ain't much good. It's not helping anyone. And there is a time and a place when we might want to have, you know, we might want to say, should politicians have put us into lockdown earlier and whatever? But a better mental health response is, okay, well, let's pause on that. We'll have that discussion another time. But for looking after me right now, why don't I move away from judgment and just move to being in this moment and just say, what is the calmest, wisest, most skillful thing for me to do in this moment to look after myself and to look after my loved ones and the people around me? And when you move away from judgment, you move to that calmer, nicer way of being. And then you're nicer to yourself. You stop judging and being so harsh on yourself. And then, I bet your bottom dollar, you're less harsh and less judgmental on other people. So it becomes a virtuous thing. And then you start to have a nicer monologue. You look up in the morning and you get up in the morning, you look in the mirror, and rather than going, oh, Christ, look at me, what the hell is going on, which sometimes I do, rarely nowadays, thankfully, unless I've had a big drinking session, and start to be kinder to myself. And when I'm kinder to myself, I might be kinder to other people. I might look around at other people who might be a bit short with me. Not that people go around and generally go around and be short to me, but, you know, sometimes when you're a shop at the moment, there's a lot of fear out there. And that can fuel other people's fear. So I always try, as best you can, even when you're wearing a mask, to smile, to be okay, and to know if other people are feeling fear, I'm not going to judge them for that. That's they're going through what they're going through, and I'm not judging them for it.
Yeah.
And therefore, I have less of a story about, all things are rubbish and whatever. I just move to a much more neutral way of just saying, I'm okay, I'm dealing with my crap, they're dealing with theirs, we can all kind of just about get by with a mess of help from each other.
Yeah, you know what, I so, so agree with all of what you just said. You know, like, it's so easy to wind yourself up with judging everyone else. Why are they doing that? What's going on there? And the narrative that we tell ourselves, you know, you said, like, the internal monologue, we tell ourselves so many things. And even about, you know, even, you know, you say depression is about the past, and you kind of, you tell yourself a story about your past and your upbringing and all these things. And when you're more mindful about it, you start to question it sometimes and think, and I've certainly done that, you know, you're like, maybe that's not true, you know, like, this is just what I'm telling myself, because actually it's only my point of view, you know. You start breaking things down, and then you think, well, if it's not true, then why am I getting bothered about it, you know? Like, I've found so many of those techniques, and that idea of not judging everything, you know. All right, I feel bad, but I'm not going to start. If I start thinking about it, and I'll create another monologue, which is probably not true, you know. Yeah. I'll just let myself off this one, you know.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
get into that position, and you're like, well, I'll let myself off, and I'll let them off as well, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. That's, yeah, completely that. And it does. It stops. It's actually not, when you're nicer to yourself, I bet you're bottom pound sterling, you're nicer to other people.
Yeah, I think so.
And a lot of what goes wrong in the world actually comes from people's own self-loathing and own issues than necessarily other people. Other people might trigger stuff in us, but if we don't do the work on ourselves, then we can't always blame other people. You know, look, there's going to be other people in this world that are going to wind us up. That's for sure. But if we're okay with ourselves and trying to be the best, to use that best version of ourselves, don't like using that much, but I think you kind of get where I'm coming from. It means we don't get dragged into other people's nonsense and other people's stories and other people's games and whatever.
I often put it in terms of if you can let go of your ego, you know, like,
yes, completely.
You know, ego is, someone says something and then you get angry. And it's really very rarely about that other person. It's about you feeling like, you know, you not being confident and you not, and all these things about you. And after a while, when you do these kind of practices, I think you start letting go of the ego a bit, and life just gets so much better. Your ego is constantly pulling you back. And I think, you know, like, sometimes you think, well, I'm going to give mindfulness a go. Then ego comes involved and it goes, oh, what are you doing that shit for? You know, and then you end up giving up. And it's all ego. And that's a Buddhist thing, isn't it?
Letting go. Absolutely. I was going to say, and, you know, and in a way, it's a really good point. So I know I'm conscious that we're coming up to the end of our session. And I think it's nice as we bring it all together to actually look back that a lot of, you know, the mindfulness practice that we have today has come out of that Eastern spirituality, those Eastern religions. And there are some people who are okay with that and really into it, and other people who are a bit anti it. But I kind of think we should give credence from where it's come. And for those people that are spiritual, they can explore that side. But a lot of, you know, those tenets of that kind of non-ego is a very interesting one to me. You know, my degree is in philosophy, so I've always chewed those bigger questions in life. Yeah. But for me, you know, so much of what goes on around the ego can be so detrimental to the to good things per se. And you just have to look at certain leaders in the world who you can see there is such a huge ego that it's all about them. It's not about what's the best thing for society, what's the best thing. And when you're in an egoless state, you start to see that we're all connected, all of us. All of us humans are connected. You know, there are 6 billion of us, isn't there, more or less, on this planet, I think. There's a lot of us, and we're all out there. And, you know, we're all having to find ways to get on together, to survive,
yeah,
and to be okay. Yeah, and we're connected to nature. This is the other big thing. I think what coronavirus has taught me from this angle is that actually everything is interconnected. You know, if we keep pushing the boundaries of kind of the planet and the environment, and then we push these things to where maybe some bat dropped something into a wet market where some animal then had some virus that then met into the human chain, food chain. And it's got, everything is interconnected. So when we start to actually let go of ego and say, you know, what's the best thing for everyone? What's the best thing for me? What's the best thing for everyone? And to be a bit less selfish, because some of the critiques of mindfulness is that it can be very self-centered. And I can kind of see why people who might not fully understand mindfulness may think that. But I think a lot of it, towards the end, we do this lovely practice at the end of a 6 or 8 week course called the befriending practice. And you start off directing it to a loved one. And you say, may they be happy and healthy. May they be free from suffering. May they have ease of being. And you say, you send those intentions to someone you love, then to yourself. And sometimes people are almost sometimes in tears because they'd never say these bloody words to themselves. Then you say it to someone who might be neutral, someone you might not get on with, and then you say it out to all living things. And everyone goes, oh, that's a bit hippie. And I was going, yeah, but maybe it is. I don't care if it is, because it leaves me with such a warm glow of the interconnectedness of everything. And when I come out of that doing that practice, I just feel this, we're all in this together, and we've got to find the best ways we can of letting go of me, and what's good for all of us together. Because if we don't think about that, we don't survive as a planet, quite frankly.
Because I see, you know, like Buddhism and mindfulness, in many ways, it's taking responsibility for yourself. You know, like you're taking responsibility for your own mental health and your well-being. And I see that as not being selfish. I see it as more like the opposite, really. You're taking responsibility. You know, that's not a selfish act. It's weird because I come back to it all the time is, you know, like they're fundamental truths, because a lot of bits, things like that we've been talking about are very similar, say, like in 12 Steps of AA. They're very similar in a lot of things, which just confirms to me that this is the way forward. You know, a lot of religion is not about taking responsibility. It's about putting responsibility elsewhere. But yet that's more valid. You know, I just think we're getting it the wrong way around. We need to come back to more of these basic truths, because I've learned over the last 2 years that this is the way forward. This is what's made me better.
Well, I like what you're saying there. A friend of mine, she's a yoga teacher, Lynette, and she's just brilliant. She's one of those people I met at university, and she's just one of those people who you can just see. She just emanates out love and goodness to everyone, and you're just in the you know, when you meet the presence of those people, and they just leave you feeling with a warm glow.
Yeah.
And she subscribes to this, it's called Integral Yoga, and their motto is truth is one, paths are many. And there's so much discord because people get into such strict interpretations, and they sign up to all these certain, you must do it this way. If you don't do it this way, it's then you can't be this, that, or the other. And yet there are a lot of decent tenets of how we should be to ourselves, to our neighbour, to the planet, to everything, that are common to nearly all world religions. And I think that's, I know we're getting into a different field there, and that's a different podcast, a different another time. But I think there is, and I think it is just that sense of, I suppose mindfulness has really helped me just feel better connected, that I have a better understanding of myself. I can manage myself better. So I can see when my mood might be dipping. Yeah. And I might just go, oh, I had a crap night's sleep last night. That's fine. I'm just going to do a bit of self-care. I'm going to have an early night. Or I might say to my mates, can I meet you another night when I'm a bit less frazzled? And then, you know, if I can manage myself better, then I can help manage what the Ashley that I give out to the rest of the world. And therefore, and then that, you know, that other people then might also be able to, you know, through learning techniques like mindfulness, might be able to manage themselves better. And also, if I can present myself as a better, calmer Ashley, then it means I'm not going to be going, I slept 4 hours last night, it's a crap day, what's wrong with you? You know, those kind of situations. And yeah. So it is both managing oneself and then helping everyone by putting forward the best version of me. I've used that several times now, and I never ever use it, apart from on today's podcast, to be honest.
But it's also, like, if you're out in the world and you're not judging people, that's a good thing, isn't it? Like, no matter what, if you're in a position, like a non-judgmental position, then it's going to be good anyway.
And you know what? We're all a work in progress. And no matter how seasoned we are in terms of mindfulness practitioners, and I've been practicing it now for 7 years, since 2013, I know that I'm going to have my own internal biases. And I know I'm going to have my days where I might rant because I've only had 4 hours sleep, although my sleep is a heck of a lot better since I've been practicing mindfulness. But I'm kind of going with a sense of gentleness and go, it's okay to be here right now. And that's fine. And to know that we all have to keep the practice going. You know, you keep doing the practice. It's like you've got to keep going to the gym to keep toned up. And if you don't, like, you know, well, 4 months of not going to the gym during coronavirus meant that when I went this week, going back to the gym was a bit of a shock.
Yeah.
But I know I have to go to the gym, just like I've got to do my mindfulness practice, because...
Yeah, yeah. I always say, like, I'm always working on my mental health. Like,
yes,
every day,
exactly.
I'm working on my mental health, because the minute I don't is the minute I can heal. And then I'm like, oh, I forgot.
Yes.
I just got sucked into this pit of shit.
Yes. And sometimes when you're at your most manic, you kind of think, no, I haven't got time for that. I haven't got time to do that. And we say mindfulness, that's the ringing of what we call a mindful bell. That should say to you, actually, wait a minute. You need 5-10 minutes out now to give yourself that mental space, because then you'll go in a much better situation, actually better equipped to deal with the rubbish you're dealing with.
Yeah.
So yes.
Well, Ashley, you've been one of those people, like the yoga person. You've just brightened my day. Because I've really
thank you.
Because as I say, I've never been done specifically mindfulness. I've had lots of different therapists, so much of it is clearly really common to everyone.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
And for me, that's really nice to hear, because it just reinforces everything to me. I'm doing all right, and I work on all of that stuff all day, every day, and it works. All I can say is it works. You know, the skeptics out there, it's about, you know, if you're really struggling and things are crap, why would you not try anything?
And I think it's important to say there's those two bits, that there's that more formal practice, which is maybe focusing on breath or sensations of the body and so on and so forth. And that takes time to master. And I know some people have done, they said, I can't do it. I just cannot do it. And I said, take the pressure off yourself. Just move away from saying you can't do it and go in the sense of openness and just give it a go. And I said, but by the way, I hate to disappoint you, but I think you're already doing some mindfulness. And they're like going, how, what do you mean? I said, well, you're quite into baking. And I think when you're into baking, you've got to be very focused that you measure out all the ingredients, you follow the instructions, a bit like painting, playing music, listening to music, all of those are informal ways. And then people go, oh. But I say to them, it's all of those three things together. It is learning the psychology, the theory behind it, and then doing the everyday mindfulness, making a cup of tea in a mindful way, etc., showering in the morning, being really present to that, and then doing informal practice. So my invitation is to people to go out there, give it a go. There's loads of good courses. There's loads of snippet videos. There's loads of good apps out there. I've got my own site, Mindfulness and Coaching with Ashley Lodge, you know, so there's lots of stuff out there. You know, give it a go if you haven't already. Look for courses in your area. The gold standard is normally an 8-week course for 2 hours a week, but there's lots of adaptations of it. Like the one I teach is normally 6 hours, 1 hour a week with daily practice of 10 minutes. So give it a go. What are you going to lose? What are you going to lose? The only caveat I'd say is if you're going through any big kind of, therapeutic intervention, if you're doing some really deep work with a therapist, always talk to them about it first, because what we all say is for some people who've had PTSD or have been going through really quite intense therapy, to maybe complete that course or work with your clinician to know that it's the right time to do it. Yep. So always do it in conjunction with your doctor or your therapist, because stuff can come out from it. So from a kind of a safeguarding and duty of care bit, it's always do it in conjunction and talk to people first, maybe, to just make sure it's the right thing for you.
Yeah.
Is what I would say.
Well, that's it, Ashley. Thank you so much. I've really, really enjoyed that. And it was because, as I say, we touched on it. We've never really gone into it. And I feel like we've really gone into it there. We've got people are going to hear it and have a really good understanding.
Good. I hope. It's quite funny. You know when you get going and I'm there talking about stuff and I'm going, oh, my God, I'm talking a lot here. Am I making it all structured and making sense of it and whatever? So hopefully it should be good. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real honour and pleasure to appear on this. So a massive thank you to you.
Thank you. It's been great, man. I've really enjoyed it. So I can't thank you enough, actually. Really good. To finally get to kind of speak to you. And I don't know. Like, I've learned a lot. I've learned loads.
Yeah, and look, Gina, and thank you for having this podcast, because I think it is such an important thing. You know, I work on a big mental health and well-being kind of committee at work, and you know, we talk about all the different groups, and I think men's mental health, I think it's great that we've got podcasts like this, because men aren't so good at talking about mental health. I think we're seeing a real sea change now, but it's so good to have podcasts like this that we can, you know, access and help more people, kind of more men, you know, talk about these things and see all the different options and different skills and techniques that are out there to help us manage our mental health. So a big thank you to you for all the good work you do.
Oh, cheers, Ashley. I'm going to say bye-bye.
Okay.
Thanks.
Cheers, mate. Ben.
Take care.
Bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.